got it on KHUM. It's our 20th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. And for our second week, we are dealing with the overarching topic of privilege, prejudice, and the violence of otherism. And joining me here in the studio is Cesar Abaca. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, and good morning.
So I guess first let's get your credentials out of the way. You teach at Humboldt State University.
That's correct. And if you let me, I would just acknowledge before I start speaking that we are in Wheatland, and as a visitor to this place, I work in the north part of the territory, and I was mindful about being a visitor to this land and a lot of respect for the song, prayer, and ceremony that happens here in Humboldt County. My name is Cesar Abarca, and I'm assistant professor at the social work department at Humboldt State University, and this is my third year here in Humboldt.
Fantastic. Now, I've been given a list of credentials. You are also a community organizer, a scholar activist, and urban farmer.
That's correct.
All right. What is an urban farmer?
An urban farmer is someone who has a lot of appreciation and love for Mother Earth and is willing to learn about growing food in places that they don't necessarily adequate to grow food. You know, I grew up in the cities. I never had any contact with the land. And then I moved to New Mexico. And that's when I learned how to grow food and the beauty of growing food and seeing the whole process from planning to planting to tending the land and weeding and then harvesting and sharing the harvest with others. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about growing food is that not only you're in touch with your spirit and the spirit of Mother Earth, but you also touch the spirits of others. And I have seen the power of healing that happens when you come as a community and grow food. So we have a community farm in Albuquerque, New Mexico, part of our organization there called Los Jardines Institute. And that's what I want to bring to Humboldt State. We've been trying to get a community garden. You would think that Humboldt will be one of those places
sure.
that will have a community garden on campus, but we don't. So as a result, we get a lot of our food that is being, you know, trucked from the Central Valley rather to, you know, tap into the local, you know, farming community.
Well, I wish you luck with that. That definitely seems like the right place to be doing it.
And that's correct. And it's been happening for 3 years. I think the effort, I think finally we're going to break ground sometime early next year. And, you know, I'm very excited to see students, you know, growing food on campus and making some of that food available to others.
Excellent. And I know off air we were talking a little bit about what we're going to be talking about. One of the things that you were wanting to talk about is the immigrant community here in Humboldt County. I know the population, the Hispanic population here in Humboldt County is rather low, but on the campus of Humboldt State, you were telling me it's at this point 39%.
That's correct. We are 39% for the fall of 2015. About 2 years ago, the university reached a threshold of 25%, and as part of the U.S. Department of Education, we qualified to be labeled as a Hispanic Server Institution. This allowed HSU to apply for specific funding related to outreaching, recruiting, retaining, and graduating Chicano Latino students. And we are in the process of securing funding, and departments can also apply separately for funding related to these efforts. And we are a growing population. It's very diverse, and you could see it in the students and the events that happened. We just had a Day of Dead celebration 2 weeks ago, and I was very surprised to see all of the students coming and come together in a place. Unfortunately, that's not reflected in the local community. We are about, you know, past 10%. I mean, in Humboldt County, but we're growing. And I think that's one of the things that is happening here is, you know, diversity is coming to Humboldt.
Well, it's one of the largest growing segments of the U.S. population.
That's correct. And I think in California, we have become the majority group. Obviously, California being one of the states that has the most concentration, you know, California, Texas, mm-hmm. right, Florida. So the idea being is that we have become more diverse and, in turn, you know, we need to have more, you know, knowledge about each other. And I think that's one of the efforts that we're trying to do, not only educating our students about the local indigenous population, but also inviting others to come and learn about our immigrant experience, because it's important for us to know each other. I think that's one of the things that end up happening that feeds into a lot of this xenophobia is the fact that we're ignorant about each other. So I think bringing people together and having dialogue is, you know, one step gap closer to really understand our experience and how common it is our experience, right? Because we are in a country that is made of immigrants, and people forget sometimes that at one point Germans and Irish and Italians were seen as foreigners and aliens and, you know, were pretty much suspicious,
everyone,
right?
Yeah, everyone but Native Americans are right. immigrants to this area.
Correct.
So,
correct.
You know, it's kind of it's kind of an interesting thing. And since we were talking about prejudice and privilege there, and we're now in the political climate, there seems to be, I guess, a lot of political hay being made at the expense of the Latino community. There is, much being said to score political points.
That's correct. And I think that's been, you know, on and off, you know, the discourse, the political discourse, and, you know, probably from the 1960s on, this kind of a going back to figure out, you know, the scapegoat group and, you know, documented, immigrants tend to be that group that, you know, doesn't have the power of the vote or economic power. Unfortunately, that's, you know, going to intensify as moving closer to the presidential elections. And I think that's why it's so important for our community to be informed about these issues and the experience, because a lot of times the assumption is that people come to this country to take advantage of the benefits that, you know, it offers. But at the same time, there's a price to pay, and at this what people sometimes don't understand. So if we were to frame our experience, there's three major steps that happen. One is the pre-migration stage, when you're kind of getting ready to leave your country. And for a lot of people who have lived in countries, that really resonates a lot. It's not easy to leave, you know, your culture, your family, you know, your food, your local community, to make a journey that you don't know if you're going to be able to make it. You know, nowadays it's even more dangerous, as we're having more violence related to drug trade, where people were able to, you know, cross the border with relatively safety. Now we are encountering, you know, people being, you know, kidnapped, people being killed. So we dealing with a lot of, issues at the border where people are trying to make it to the United States, and that has make it very difficult to do the journey. And then, you know, we have a shift in the waves of immigrants, because a lot of people are coming from Central America, so it's taking even longer to make it all the way to the United States. You know, the second stage is kind of once you get to the United States, and then the, you know, adaptation and survival that happens when you're here. Some people come with social support. Some people come on their own and establish their communities here. And, you know, a lot of them end up, you know, in places like L.A. or, you know, San Francisco. But a lot of communities nowadays are moving into areas where there's more jobs available, which means away from the ethnic enclaves that usually typically were kind of protecting people. And now we've seen people like coming to Humboldt, for instance, as a first stop, where in the past people will have other places to go. And then the third stage is, you know, the acculturation phase, where we kind of start integrating to the community, right? You know, you don't come to a host country and then, you know, leave away from it. You start speaking English, you start going to school, children start integrating with other children, you know, young people end up integrating with other young people, and then adults eventually end up, because of work, integrating to the community. So we are a community that we feel that we contribute to this country not only as labor force, but also as we bring our culture and our food, our traditions to this country, and I think, you know, that's the valuable asset that we bring. And the other piece is that we come here to really improve our lives. And I think that's a motivation that we bring, because we come from places where opportunities are not there. So when we come here, we really want to take advantage of that. So I think, you know, it's important for people to understand that process, because a lot of times we tend to put everybody in a box and saying, oh, you know, people just come to have babies. So people come to get the benefits or education. But we come here and pay a high price, because we work in the low paid jobs, low skilled jobs, and then we have to move up on the ladder. And, you know, it's not easy. And a lot of times, a lot of our communities, because of our nature, we don't get to really venture out in the community or learn from others. So I think a lot of immigrants are really interested in learning about the local community and learning about others. It's just that you need to create those spaces for that dialogue to happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, as we are all immigrants in this country, you know, whether, you know, like for me personally, I'm only a second generation American. All of my grandparents emigrated from Eastern Europe. There's many people who have been here a lot longer than my family has been. So I'm very, very well aware of that. But the when you have a population, you know, coming from Mexico or Central America, and you've got a population with darker skin or looking different than the white community, they'll always look different. There are people I've talked to of Latino descent who have been in this country for like 5 generations, mm-hmm. 10 generations,
right.
And can still be treated the same way. The same thing is painted on them because for me, I'm white. I get the white privilege, even though I'm only a second generation American. Mm-hmm. It's an unfairness that the Latino population has to deal with.
Right, and I think that's one of the issues that we face in the whole idea of how people see us as a very homogeneous group and very, very heterogeneous. Like you mm-hmm. mentioned, there's people who actually went to 3 separate governments in your generation, right? So first
sure.
they were from, the Spanish colony, and then they went into the country of Mexico, and then, they became, United States. So the whole idea of, there's a saying from a Chicano group in LA called Aztlan Underground to say, we didn't cross the border crossed us, and it's surreal, right? Borders are created in these imaginary lines, but communities continue to have a connection, beyond borders. And obviously we have Native Americans along the U.S.-Mexican border that have members in both sides. And how do you then keep the community together when you have an international border in between? In my experience, I came as a young person. I'm considered a 1.5 generation. So my parents are considered first generation because they were adults where they came. But in the literature and in the scholarship, now we have created a 1.5 generation, which speaks about young people coming, already have some kind of identity before coming to the United States, and then kind of taking a second identity by being here. I have all my higher education here in the United States. And I was thinking the other day that I have learned so much about academics through the United States that I don't even know a lot of the terms that I learned in Spanish, right? So if I was to teach the stuff that I teach now in Spanish, it would be really hard to do because all my formation in academics has been in the United States. So I think the complexity of our community is real, and there's still a lot of, divisions within our community, right? Because we are not, all in the same page. Some people are very pro-immigration while others are anti-immigrants. We have the first governor, Hispanic governor in New Mexico, for instance, and she's pretty anti-immigration, even though in New Mexico, people can get driver license. Now in California, we brought them back for undocumented residents. So the idea of us being a one group is pretty far reach. I think we are very complex, not only the person who just arrived or the person who's been here for generations, but I think we all see our ability to really integrate. And I see it here in Humboldt as, we are integrated into the community and kind of creating some friction, right? Because we are kind of a third group that, is coming here with a significant number and our families living here. One thing that is being difficult to conceive in our community is that because people are so dispersed, even in Fortuna, which is the majority of the people that live here, the Latino community, we don't have like an enclave like other parts of the state. So you kind of come here and you see where are all the people, and then you go to church on Saturday and that's where you see people congregate, and that's when you realize. Or at the university as well, we just mentioned that we have 39% Chicano Latino students, but you see them all over the place, and it's until you get an event that you get see them all congregated. So I think we're seeing a little bit of pushback with our community and our students now that, we are more visible, we are there more in numbers. And I think it's very, very important to be mindful about that, because one of the things that we want to promote is safety and understanding about our issues, because we're sharing the same issues. We have an economic problem in this country, and, we are suffering like everybody else. When somebody gets laid off, we get laid off as well. When, restaurants are shutting down or hotels are shutting down, we are being, laid off as well. So we are the ones who kind of feel a lot of the economic impacts, because we are kind of at the front of a lot of labor markets here, and not only locally but nationwide. So I think for me, one of the messages that I want to bring is this issue about creating opportunities for us to learn more about each other. I have one student in the master's program who started those efforts by creating a curriculum to teach the Latino community about indigenous history and culture. And I thought that was a great bridge to create. And then vice versa, we probably need to create curriculum also for the Latino community to teach indigenous people about our experience so they can better understand who we are and, you know, what are we about. And then trying to find, people who can be allies to each other, right? Because we're dealing with the same issues. We're dealing with the same problems. And I think we can come together in unity. And I think that's the message that, you know, we are here in this country and we're here in a way that we want to contribute. We just want the opportunity to do so.
Absolutely. And let's talk a little bit about this right here, the Nourishing Roots. This is coming up on the 13th and 14th of November.
Sure. This is a conference that is student-led. There's three organizations on campus, the Black Student Union, the Free Organization, and Mecha, who are coming together, all of our students of color. They felt that they needed to have a space to have dialogue related to some of the issues that we're facing in the university. One thing that is important to mention is that sometimes we have overused the word diversity, and we sometimes confuse diversity with tokenism, right, to having a person representative of each particular group, especially marginalized groups. And what we have realized at the university that it's not enough just to have, you know, people from different places coming together, but we need to have spaces where we can learn and teach each other. And that's what the students pretty much put together. So the conference is going to be taking place this Friday and on Saturday at Humboldt State University, and the community is welcome. It's free. We're going to have three major workshops. The first one is going to be on Friday from 3 to 6, and we're going to bring La Loba, which is a traditional healer, who's going to come and provide a workshop, and she's going to be doing some healing practices with our students in our community. The second workshop is being hosted by the Metro organization. It's going to be an issue related to nutrition. It's called Decolonize Your Diet, and kind of understanding where some of our foods is coming from. And this is, to me, very, very important. I'm teaching right now a master's level course related to wellness and sustainability. And one of the things that we find in indigenous paradigms is the whole sacredness of food. The sacredness of food, not only as medicine, but also as a way in which we can share and, you know, gift-giving. And the importance culturally of food. Obviously, we have the Yurok tribe and the salmon as one of the ways in which we can learn very directly how important it is to preserve these sacred foods and the sacredness of, you know, the ecosystem where we're in. And that's going to be the conversation. What are some of the ways that we can bring back some of our traditional foods? As you know, in Mesoamerica, our diet is based on corn. So, we have been substituting corn by wheat. And, you know, going back to that. So the students are going to lead the discussion. They're going to have some cooking demonstrations so people can learn about how to bring some of the, traditional ingredients. And then on Saturday, we're going to have the Seventh Generation Fund. And I want to give a shout out for the Seventh Generation Funds, who have been very generous to a lot of us at Humboldt State University, kind of being a place where we can go and seek assistance and guidance when we're dealing with some of these issues at the university, particularly dealing with Native Americans in the community. And they've been very generous in providing. Tia Soros Peters has been tremendous in helping us and guiding us and being very patient with us as we learn how do we better work with the indigenous community locally. So they're going to present on some of the work they've been doing related to giving back to the community to kind of provide funds for them to continue to the programming. And we're very happy to have them on campus and have them a partnership with them related to the student-led conference.
Fantastic. Now, one of the things you mentioned was the in the indigenous foods and bringing that back. You know, if you take a look, you know, there's just generations and generations and generations of peoples who have lived on a certain diet, and then when it gets rapidly shifted, whole populations have a very hard time dealing with that. When you introduce things like sugar, refined sugar, and wheat and whatnot, it leads to obesity problems and diabetes, and returning to something that a more traditional diet absolutely has been shown to help tremendously in the nutrition and health of people.
Yeah, and there's been several studies related to that, how assimilation of immigrants have kind of a negative effect on their health, you know, not only because we come here and work, but stress, like you say, diabetes, you know, lack of exercise. Sometimes people work two jobs. There's no time for recreation. There's no time for rest. So we have known through the different studies that have been done in the United States that, you know, the traditional diet of the United States is heavy on saturated fat, on, you know, calories and the lack of physical activity or the lack of spaces, particularly a lot of our students come from urban environments. And, you know, you come to Humboldt and so much opportunities to do physical exercise, but sometimes people are so immersed in their work and the studies that they don't get an opportunity to enjoy. But definitely something to bring to the table as far as, you know, using food as a way. We had a conversation in my class about food and the importance of food. And it was such a rich conversation because everybody can relate to food, right? It doesn't have to be an ancient food, but any kind of a food. And then you start a conversation, and the stories that people tell about the food are so important, right? Because it tells a story about generations of people in their families who are passing it on this particular food. So this is a really interesting point because a lot of people end up denying that they have any culture, but they don't realize until you kind of give them the opportunity to connect. Oh, so food is culture, right? And our students, you know, were sharing in groups, and they were so excited to share about what kind of a foods they have. And then they found some things that were in common, right? You know, the sacredness of food, the way in which we share food, the connection to emotion and the spirit when we sharing food in our families or in community. So all of that, you know, we find common ground. And to me, that's very, very important for people to come together and realize that we have so much in common. We focus so much in difference, but, you know, we have a lot in common that can bring us together.
Absolutely. Now, getting back to one thing you were talking about before, where a lot of the political dialogue is that, you know, people are immigrating to this country to take advantage of the handouts. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, like almost all immigrants who come to this country, it's the opportunities that this country provides. There's lots of different opportunities for jobs and work, and the reality is, I mean, the numbers bear it out that immigrants work hard, very hard, often two, three jobs, to get by. And the argument of that, well, they're taking all the jobs away from, you know, America, which is horse hockey.
Right.
I mean, the reality is, you know, they're taking jobs that no one else will take.
Right. Yeah. And the other thing is, and I think we need to talk about this aspect of the economic development, is that, you know, people think, oh, all these immigrants come and send them money back home. But yet we contribute so much to the local community, right?
Absolutely.
So we buy food, we pay rent. So rent turns into local taxes, right? Because your landlord or landlady has to pay taxes on
Absolutely.
The property. You know, we buy gas, we buy cars, we register our cars. So all these economic activities is related to what we contribute to this country. And since we don't have a comprehensive immigration reform, United States, people have been living here for 20, 25 years, 30 years without
Absolutely.
Any legal status. So that means that these people have been working all this time, and they're not going to benefit for Social Security. Also, with immigration reform in 1996, what ended up happening is that any new resident, immigrant who become legal resident, they have to wait 10 years to receive benefits. So even if you are have legal status, you have to wait 10 years in order for you to be able to get some of the benefits. So that's important to mention, because a lot of time people think that we just come and we just start receiving a welfare check, you know, the next day, which is not true, right? And I think it's important to mention that, because a lot of times, you know, we tend to assume that the benefits come right away, but a lot of times end up being for the next generation. Like my parents came to this country because of economic reasons, and then I had the opportunity to go to school, and I was privileged enough to be able to do it. But, you know, for each of me, there's, you know, thousands of people who end up, you know, working and not being able to have an opportunity to go to school. So I think my job now as a professor at Humboldt State is to try to, you know, do as much as I can to retain our students. We have the worst retention record in the CSU system. We're losing about 35% of our students
Wow.
the first year. I mean, there's a lot of reasons. You know, economic reasons, is really expensive to come on in and out of the area. It's very expensive to live here in Humboldt, like everybody knows. You know, food and gas and rent
rent is very expensive.
It's very expensive on campus as well. And then, you know, people feeling isolated and, they really miss home and then leaving. But what I want to point out about this fact is that, you know, we put so much effort to get the students here, to get them into the four-year institution, whether it's community college or us, not only themselves, but their families, their communities, their schools, right? So we have a public system that is educating us. So this is a big effort to get them into a college. And for us to lose so many students is really a crisis. And we're having some efforts on campus, but I think we're not doing enough to really deal with this crisis. And I find it, that not only our students are suffering, but also the local community, because we're having this conversation about how Humboldt State has, recruiters all over the state, and we bring students all the way to the U.S.-Mexico border. But we're not doing a good job in recruiting the local community, the indigenous community. And I think we need to be doing both. I don't think it has to be one of those issues of either or, but, we can do a good job both ways, right?
Absolutely.
The local community and the faraway communities, but our job is to make sure that we not only bring them here, because that's one step, but we retain them here. We make the students find home here and then graduate, because I think that's our job, to make sure that those students graduate and then they can move on to other things.
Sure. I mean, I also teach at Humboldt State, and I've had a few students this year drop out partway through for the same thing, as they just had to head back home. They couldn't. They had trouble coping with it, and so it's an interesting thing. I guess I don't know how one would address that, but I wasn't aware that we had such a high population of that.
Yeah, we do, and unfortunately, because we recruit so far away, that has a specific repercussion, because a lot of times those students don't realize how far we are. They see us in the map and they see how beautiful we are, and they come here and they fall in love with the place, and then break comes, like we're going to have fall break in 2 weeks,
right?
And then they realize, oh, it's going to cost me an arm and a leg to go home and come back. And some students now, what they're doing is trying to save and stay here for the fall break and then go home during the winter break.
Yep.
So definitely a reality for a lot of students. And now we're dealing with issues of food insecurity. I mean, that's something that a study that is now is being performed. One of my colleagues, Jill McGuire, is involved with a CSU system-wide effort to find more information about food insecurity on campus. What we find out at Humboldt State is there were students were eating only one meal a day and then snacking the rest of the day because they didn't have enough money to pay for a full meal plan. Some people are eating on, pasta or Cheetos, right? And one of the things that the school started was a food pantry, and now it's becoming like a full-blown program where we provide food for students. There's even some fresh produce being brought from the local farming community to feed our students. So, food insecurity is a reality. I think we assume that everybody can afford to go to college and buy a meal plan, but that's not true. A lot of our students are working class. A lot of them come from poor communities. So, the whole idea that we can provide you on is really hard to imagine. So now we're finding the need, and now we're filling out that gap, and the students now are having at least a place where they can get some food.
The other thing that there is, not only is there food insecurity, there's housing insecurity.
That's right.
There are a lot of students who are homeless. Mm-hmm. There are students that camp out, move from place to place, or couch surf, or and I've had that with several students in the past, and it's that needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. I think the student newspaper had a whole article at the beginning of the semester of this situation, either because the students didn't follow through or apply late to the residences. Whatever the reason is, it makes it even more difficult to concentrate in your school if you having to live in your car or you don't have a permanent place to stay. But definitely, the whole idea of, we kind of overlap that intersection between being a student and coming from other communities. You can feel a little bit the tension happening in the community, because not only you see an outsider, but you also see associated with the university. So I think that's important for us to understand, is that we are trying to get the students to serve more the community, and we have efforts not only in social work, but other departments, sociology, child development, education, who are, in the community doing internships, helping the community as much as we can. So we are contributing. I mean, it's a small drop in the bucket, but I think we're trying to be more mindful about how we can allocate more resources to the community. So not only the students are practicing or learning from the experience, but also the community can benefit from some of the knowledge and the skills that some of the students could offer.
Yes. Well, we are unfortunately unfortunately out of time, but if you've got any last thoughts that you'd like to share before we wrap this up?
Sure. The last thing that I want to say, I just want to send a shout out to the True North Community Organizing Network and the organizers, René Saucedo and Fernando Paz, who will be doing a tremendous work in bringing unity in the community. It's a tremendous effort trying to bring the faith-based community, the indigenous community, and the Latino community together. And I think, you know, that's something that is, we have become more of a visible presence because the organizing has to do with being able to have a voice in the table, being able to have an impact on our community. And I think that's what we want. You know, we have a philosophy that we speak over for ourselves. So I'm only speaking for myself here, and hopefully others will speak for themselves and allow us to have our own voice and being able to have a place in the table.
Cesar Abaca, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for the invitation.
You bet. And we'll continue our conversation tomorrow at 9 o'clock. My guest will be Dr. Lauren Cannon, and he will be talking about the topic that we have been continuing on, which is prejudice and privilege and the violence of otherisms in the trans community.